God is love without forgiving. Without love, you're only living an imitation of life.
All right, everyone. Welcome to the first spinoff podcast for the Interracial John. Welcome to Interracial John Vintage Movies. I am your host, at Leslie Mack, and my co-host with me today
is at Very White Guy.
He's very white indeed.
That's fitting for today's movie.
Yeah, it sure is. And this is a new podcast from the Interracial John, which is going to go through some vintage movies, some old movies, and give some commentary, some thoughts, some details on the movie. And this week we are doing The Imitation of Life, the 1959 release of Imitation of Life. When did you first see this movie, Drew?
You know, we were talking about this, and I think it was maybe we were living together but not quite engaged or married yet. So it had to be 16, 17 years ago, 14, gotcha. 15 years. And, but we definitely saw it together. I had not seen it
prior to.
Prior to.
Gotcha.
And I kind of knew about it, right? It's a pretty well-known movie. So I was familiar with the little bit of it, but I think, in fact, we were talking on the podcast the other day that the 30 under 30 movies that black folks should see, and one was The School Days, and I said that I didn't really have an understanding of colorism and some of the stuff, the concepts in School Days, despite having seen it prior to being with you. So I definitely remember when we saw this together, it was a kind of a moment. We weren't talking about race and some of those things the way we do now, but it was definitely I really appreciated having that space to watch it with you, and I loved watching it with you yesterday. It was just really, really enjoyable way to spend the day.
Yeah, it was pretty neat. I mean, I haven't seen it in quite a number of years myself. I honestly can't remember the first time that I saw it, because as a black person, it's been a pretty constant movie in my life. I think, I can't count the number of times I've seen it. Really, I've seen it so many times. But watching it yesterday with kind of more of an analytical eye, taking notes in preparation for, our discussion today was a little bit different. I had always just experienced it as a moviegoer, and this was a little bit different experience, but I really enjoyed it.
And,
Before we go any further, let me just let people know where they can find us. You can catch us on Stitcher Radio, Interracial John. You can also find us on our website, interracialjohn.com. You can follow us on Twitter at interracialjohn. And we are also on Facebook and Instagram, Interracial John as well.
And that's J-A-W-N.
That's right.
Interracial John. That's a word Philly cats use for anything and everything.
That's exactly right. And also, just to, for those of you who don't know much about this movie, Imitation of Life, quick synopsis. A struggling young actress with a six-year-old daughter sets up housekeeping with a homeless black widow and her light-skinned 8-year-old daughter who rejects her mother by trying to pass for white. So that's just a general description. Go ahead.
The theme song, I didn't notice yesterday. And just let's start with that. What movie has theme songs other than Bond movies anymore? But the verse it ended on, without love, there is no life. It's an imitation of life.
That's right.
I didn't grasp that yesterday when we watched it.
Yeah, it's a great song, great opening. They don't do movies like this anymore.
No,
they sure don't.
And you can tell from the moment it starts, right? It's got that big Hollywood kind of production and soundstage, and I mean, it's got a score. Who has a movie with a score anymore? But everything about it just looks and feels just really big. I think they do movies on this scale, but now it's green screen and special effects and CGI. And it's typically, like Avatar and summer blockbusters. You don't see drama treated this way. So that's really nice.
Not at all. So the movie was released in April 17th of 1959 to much fanfare. It's actually based on Fanny Hurst's book that was released in 1933. It is actually a remake of the original Imitation of Life movie, which came out in 1934, just a year after the book came out. And that original black and white movie starred Claudette Colbert in the white female role, obviously. A little side note about that original production, there was a little bit of contention as to how they were going to handle specifically one of the main points of the the book and obviously the movie as well, which is the light-skinned daughter of the black housekeeper.
You're talking about the production code?
Yeah, the production code, which was in place there. This is pre-civil rights movement. Obviously, Jim Crow is still law of the land. And so production code number 6, this was movie production code, so they had standards and practices aboard then, and they had a production code number 6, which prohibited showing miscegenation on screen. Wow.
And they thought the daughter, even though they didn't show relations and her husband was that character's husband was widow. She was a widow. Even just having an interracial or mixed daughter was problematic in 1934.
Yeah, because if you are not allowing to show miscegenation, so she's the product of such a union.
Sure.
So what? How is that to be portrayed on screen? Which is really interesting.
And correct me if I'm. Did I not either hear or read when I was looking at some of this that this is one of the first leading roles for an African American male or female ever in a Hollywood production?
Yeah, absolutely. It really was groundbreaking. The book was groundbreaking. Both movies were very groundbreaking. It's interesting. The first one at the time, you know, certainly when the second one came out, was kind of seen as the more, I guess, technical, you know, success. Or
which one? The second one?
The first one.
The first one.
The 34 was seen as more, not to say progressive. It certainly was progressive for 34, but just more critically acclaimed.
Okay.
But now you hear people talk a lot more about the 59 movie because though it starred Lana Turner, who, you know, for definitely was the biggest star in the movie, that it did, the direction allowed room for the black actress, Juanita Moore, who played the black lead, and also the
Oscar nominated,
yeah. and the young woman who played Susan Kohler, who played the biracial daughter, to really shine and kind of overshadow this huge star. And that definitely was not the case in the 34 film. The 34 film, Claudette Colbert is the star of the
picture. And you know what? I didn't know about the 59, the Lana Turner, and maybe I'm an idiot or something. I had no idea about her real life mother-daughter struggles, right? There was some legal matters.
Yeah, lots
that she
about that.
Somebody?
You know what? Let's come back to that because
okay.
I think it comes up a little more organically in the story itself.
Okay, okay.
But certainly we'll go into that. A couple more tidbits. As Very White Guy mentioned, there were 2 Oscar nominations for the movie. Susan Kohner, who played the daughter, Sarah Jane, and Juanita Moore, who played Annie. Both were nominated for an Oscar. Susan happened to win the Golden Globe that year for supporting actress.
Oh,
so that's
a
pretty big, and she also won for Best New Actress, interestingly
and now,
enough.
She played the daughter that passes, but she was, if I'm not mistaken, was she Hispanic in heritage?
She was part Mexican and part Czech. So she was of mixed descent, but not black and white.
Versus the 34 version where Freddie Washington was of mixed heritage, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It was the fourth most successful motion picture in 1959,
wow.
Grossing about $6.4 million.
Oh, man.
It was Universal International's top grossing film that year, and it remained its most successful film for almost a decade, almost 68. There are 2 pop songs that were written about this movie. One by Diana Ross and the Supremes came out in 69 called I'm Living in Shame, and an REM song called Imitation of Life. Both of those are based on this film.
Well, I did not know REM song Imitation of Life. I've never heard it.
Me neither. So there you go.
I don't want to play it either.
I hate REM.
Sorry to bash REM.
It's funny. I looked this up and I was like, oh, if I had liked the group, I would have totally gotten that, but I really didn't.
Whoa.
So do you have anything else to add before we jump into, you know, kind of going through the details? And we'll play some clips as well give our thoughts on things.
You know, I had so much fun watching this movie and spending the day and talking about it. And even as I learned a lot about both the 34 and the 59 production, things that I found fascinating and maybe they are germane or not. But Freddie, she was asked to pass in real life. She was told that if she were to present herself as white, that she'd get more roles. And not only did she refuse, but she formed the Negro Acting Guild. So she's a little bit of a pioneer in that regard.
Absolutely.
I thought that was really, again, that was completely news to me. And then there was I had read a commentator, sort of a film historian, that was comparing and contrasting the 34 and 59 versions. And he said that between those 25 years, not much culturally had changed for black Americans. Mm. And that was a bit of a sad statement on America. And some might even argue that you know, not a whole lot has changed even since then. But I thought that interesting that 25 years had passed and the story was still very timeless, still very appropriate at that time.
Yeah, interestingly, one of the things that is of contention that they do change between the 34 and the 59 film is that, as in the book, the white female lead, Laura, is able to make her fortune due in part to a recipe from the housekeeper slash maid character.
Right, the pancakes.
Right. I think it's waffles in the book and pancakes in the movie, or okay, vice versa in the 34 movie. And at some point they sign this big deal and you know, they start making a bunch of money, and she brings a contract to the maid and says, hey, you know, we want to be partners. And she says, oh no, I just want to stay being your maid and keep things
right,
the way things
right,
are.
Right.
So they kind of felt that that was not going to be culturally acceptable in 59. So they switched it around and had Laura have her success on her own merits.
But she still offered to bring Annie in at some point. Annie said, no, no. We'll talk about it when we get to that point in the movie. But she says, you know, you've given me everything I want. I don't need anything else. Like, she had a contract for her.
Well, she had, I mean, she was compensating her.
Compensation, I
mean.
It wasn't quite sharing a fortune from pancake waffle, but interesting.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
So the movie opens up at a place that a very white guy wants to go to so badly.
That was the first thing I wrote down in my notes is, you have got to friggin' take me to Coney Island. I know it not looks like it did in 19. Well, so the 59 movie was actually set in 40. It started in 47.
Yeah, 47.
Right. But so I know that Coney Island hasn't looked like 47 or 59 in a long, long time. But man, I want to go.
All right. Well, after frantically searching for her lost daughter, Susie, at Coney Island, an attractive widow named Laura Meredith finds her playing with Sarah Jane, a light-skinned black girl. Laura then meets Sarah Jane's single black mother, Annie Johnson, and a white photographer named Steve Archer, who takes some photographs of the girls. So my funny thing is, as soon as the movie opens, I'm like, look at this. Starts with a lost little white girl kicking off the action.
Well, in a lot of the movies, almost at Lana Turner's character's expense, right? Laura's
definitely
almost the, I don't say the butt of the joke. That's not fair.
She certainly is not. She comes
flawed
off the worst.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, yeah. And it starts with her losing her daughter.
Yeah, it's like, what was she doing? She lost her daughter.
And I just, you know, she randomly meets, I think she interacted with two people, and, you know, they both end up being significant roles in the rest of her life.
Pretty significant, yeah, exactly.
And in fact, I don't want to put you on blast, but what was, you think, if I wrote something down about Coney Island, one, I want to go. Two, what was the other thing about losing a daughter? What would I have written down?
Oh, gosh, the Miss Piggy bathing suit.
Miss Piggy bathing suit. So I don't know if you want to tell the genres about that story.
Nah, they don't need to hear that. No. But it wasn't at Coney Island. It was at Brighton Beach, but that's okay.
Well, you got lost. You blamed your sisters.
It
and you were wearing
fault
a Miss Piggy bathing suit.
FYI, it was their
maybe
fault.
That another podcast, but it really made me think of that.
So there is a bit of a confusion when they first meet, because Sarah Jane looks white,
right.
Laura thinks that Annie is just taking care of her, and when she discovers that Annie's actually Sarah Jane's mother, Annie says, oh, that surprises most people. She favors her father. She says, and this is critical to me, she says, he was practically white. And when she says that line, she looks up in the sky as if it was like, oh, he was practically white.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I remember, and in fact, this is something that has stuck with me every time I've seen the movie. I remember that moment of her making this comment. And one other thing is that, and I have to take some contention with the descriptor where it says, that I read earlier, which was just a general synopsis of the movie, that a homeless black widow. I did not get that she was a widow.
So I'll talk about that in the setup. But so my takeaway from that scene was a little bit differently. I glommed on to the, how long have you taken care of her?
Hmm.
So that's Laura asking Annie. And the assumptive is that you're taking care of this white girl. You're
right.
A maid. And, you know, right away she gets corrected and she goes, oh, I hadn't thought of that.
Well, it wasn't quite right away, because she does say, oh, all her life.
Yeah, a couple of sentences. But I remember thinking, one, that was a very deliberate use of language, and that they didn't take that fish out of water sort of miscommunication between her and Annie and Laura very far. You know, before they leave the beach scene within a few minutes, and she understands that she's daughter. She has that comment you said about he was practically white. But so I found this sort of deliberate use of language very subtle, and I don't know if it's the writer, the director, editor, but not a wasted word in this movie. And that sort of is the beginning of their relationship. And it starts with, how long have you taken care of her? And then my takeaway with that he was practically white was that it was framed in such a way to make it clear that he was not white, that he was African-American.
Yeah, that's a good point, that I did make a point to say he was practically white, yeah. Not that he was
right,
white.
Right.
But I also remember her saying she did not say he was dead. She said he left before Sarah Jane was born.
He said he left before she was born. Like she,
he left before she was born. Right. And you get no other information about this man for the rest of the entire movie. You get a pretty significant background on Laura's dead husband, who actually is dead. And she goes into the fact that he was a small town theater director and she was an actress with him. And that's what, you know, pushed her to want to live out her dream, and he was such a great person. But all you get about this
is that he left
practically white, and he left before Sarah Jane was
dead. Down about the setup that, you know, I get that Annie was struggling, that's clear,
right.
But from everything you get in the movie information wise, she had no home, no job, no place to stay, no anything, you know, barely the clothes on her back before randomly meeting Laura and Susie.
At one point, there's a quote where she said that she came from somewhere where her color deviled her baby, and anything is better than that.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
So she makes a point to say, you know, in her convincing of Laura to they can make it. Because Laura says it's really hard. Things aren't pretty here. And she's like, it's a hell of a lot better than where I came from.
Once again, to the setup. So they're, you know, quickly right away.
I can keep going. You want me to keep going?
Well, I was just going to say the thing about, so here's Annie, who's husband left her apparently, and she's struggling, has nowhere to live, no home, no job, no place to stay. Here's Laura, a widow, and maybe he left her off really well.
She didn't say it was her husband, by the way, either.
Who, Laura?
No, Annie.
Oh, Annie. Oh, I didn't catch that either.
She just said her father.
You're right.
These are subtle.
I said language was really...
Language is important in this movie.
In this movie, very much.
And how they treat each of
these
characters.
There's not a wasted word. So Laura's apartment is this like a mansive thing with a servant's quarters off the kitchen? Like, I don't know what kind of widow she was. She was unemployed, you know, trying to get modeling work. So I thought that's
well,
the
whole
setup. Well,
she said she saved for 5 years. So clearly she put some money together to do this.
Well, boy, saving for 5 years as a white woman in 1947 got you an apartment with a servant's quarters.
Apparently.
It's pretty good.
Well, it's just a room. But anyways, Laura discovers that Annie and Sarah Jane have no place to go. And although she's poor herself, quote unquote, white
the
people
servant's
poor,
quarter. Apparently. Poor. Okay, white poor.
Having come to New York in search of an acting career, she invites the two to stay the night in her small apartment. In exchange for a small room, Annie offers to keep house and look after Susie while Laura seeks acting and modeling jobs. So we start off as soon as they get to the house with this exchange regarding the white baby doll and the black baby doll.
Oh, man. And I got to be honest. I don't know why, but the actress Karen Dicker that played the young...
You hate that character.
I do. I don't know why. It's something about the way... And maybe that's what she was supposed to do.
She was supposed to be very gritty.
Bratty.
Very bratty and very spoiled.
She throws that, you know, I don't want the black doll, and she throws it on the ground.
Well, Sarah Jane, I actually didn't mind that actress. I didn't like the actress playing Susie. I like Sarah Jane. I thought she was... effectively angry at the situation she was in. Because I can only imagine it being very confusing for a child.
I suppose.
So I thought her brightiness was warranted. Susie, on the other hand, I don't know what the hell she had to be upset about.
That's what I'm talking about. I was irritated with that actress that played the Susie character. But then you're talking about the doll and that whole scene when she drops it and they zoom in on it.
So who were you... I'm confused as to who
I wasn't
who
confused.
Were,
I was, I'm saying...
No, I'm confused. Who were you saying was irritating?
The little white girl.
Okay, but she didn't throw any dolls.
I know. I said the wrong thing. I said after that, when she had the scene and that Sarah Jane throws the doll down, and because she was mad about the doll. Susie was too. Like, I want the white doll.
Let's give Susie a little bit of credit. It was her doll. She had just gotten the black doll, and here she has a black girl in her room.
Fair enough.
Hands the girl the doll, and the girl says, I want that one. I don't want the black one. And Susie says to her, but I've had that doll my whole life. It's my baby doll.
Okay, all right.
And she gets upset about that. Now, I'm not saying the actress isn't irritating because she is, but I don't think she was unwarranted in wanting her own crap. I mean, it is her stuff.
Fair enough.
But Sarah Jane says, this comes back later in the story, she says, why do we always have to live in the back?
Mm.
She says to her mother, because her mother's like, come on, you're just tired. Let's go. Let's put you away. In the midst of all this, Laura wakes up the next morning and she discovers that Annie has cleaned the house and ironed all of her clothes. When she protests, Annie says, oh, Miss Laura, I like taking care of pretty things.
That line drove me. I wrote it down right away. And I don't know if it was intended to be, you know, a subtle nod, but it seemed almost like, you know, that sort of narrative, like, oh, these black people are such pretty little creatures. It was weird. I don't know.
I don't know how that's pretty little, but Annie was saying that.
I know. I'm just saying that the language again.
The language is important, but the language that's here, this is a very, you know, you have to remember this movie is marketed to white people.
Okay.
Okay, so if it's marketed to a white person in 1950, 1960-ish, this is heart of the civil rights movement, okay? And you have to imagine that, as you mentioned, that there's not much difference culturally between 34 and 59, with the exception of this impetus of the civil rights movement. You are trying to portray a three-dimensional black character, but one that's comfortable for white people to see.
I gotcha.
So they have to frame her with these things where she is happy in this subservient role. Just that she is subservient, because that's one thing, she's accepting of the role.
No, that nothing has changed and she's smiling and happy.
Correct.
And still
she's
my
happy
servant
to
and
take care of this pretty
woman.
Thing, of course.
I guess that was the sort of apologist fantasy of
it was
of Southern.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you have to take movies, especially with entertainment, you have to take them in the context that they're in.
Sure.
And I think it was very smart of the director, who I'll talk about a little bit later. He was just really great. He's a German filmmaker. I made some amazing movies, this being one of his best, and just really honed in on subtle ways to get this point across of how absurd the white Laura's character is in the face of the true hardships that this black character is facing.
Yeah.
So I think that they did a really great job of doing it, but still, you know, you have to put these kinds of lines in there so that the audience can take in the rest of it. Otherwise, you're going to lose ground trying to get your point across.
And it, again, so much of it's so subtle that if it had been on the nose, or, you know, typically in movies now you get hit over the head with stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't think it would have played as well. I think people would have maybe not heard the message for being it too obvious, right?
Yeah, so I think it needs to be a little bit
like subliminal.
Subliminal in nature, absolutely.
Yeah, and interesting, he was European.
Yeah, very well.
And so effective at it.
Very effective. And so Annie then at this point mentions that line that, you know, as in her convincing Laura that she definitely should stay and they should try and make this work out, the four of them, that, you know, where she came from, she came from a place that where her color deviled her baby and that anything was better than that. Shortly thereafter, Laura gets a job, a modeling job for a flea powder ad. And actually, I thought that scene seems like a throwaway, but in hindsight, looking at the movie last night, I realized that it really is meant to show you how low on the totem pole Laura is.
Sure. Because everyone was, in fact,
they make a point of treating the dog better than her several times in the scene.
I was going to say specifically that the director, there was a person there for the dog that gave the dog better treatment. And I think that scene is meant to set up sort of Lana's movement from, at this point, you know, the lowly doing the dog flea commercials to her fully becoming this big Broadway star.
Absolutely.
You know, so I agree. It wasn't a throwaway at all.
Yeah, it definitely put everything in context.
She had to start at the bottom.
That's right. Okay, so one evening, Steve, the photographer mentioned the first scene, comes by with photographs, and the next day he takes Laura to lunch. Obviously, he's smitten with her. Later, Laura invents a lie that gets her into the office of one Alan Loomis, a well-known theatrical agent. He comes on to her, invites her to a party, and then he comes on to her and tries to make this pitch that, you know, a successful actress has to be willing to do anything.
Yeah.
She leaves angrily. She runs home and sobs in frustration. Who comforts her, of course, but Annie.
Well, and to that scene, there was a couple of really, I thought, not pivotal, but very important kind of moments. So one, she gets into there, like you said, by lying, but just, you know, like a boss, just from moment one, she is no take prisoners, just really kind of, you can see her being sort of this person that she is.
Yeah. And very manipulative. And it's a manipulation in a very specific way, because she feeds off of the other person's insecurity in her manipulation.
And it's not sexual either.
No. It's a very like, I'm going to, okay, let me size this up. What can I pitch onto in this person? And then she dives right into it.
And I think that it belies her character, and that at the moment when she, so there's two things that are interesting. She calls Annie because she's trying to, you know, say, change this fake appointment I don't have, right? She's continuing this lie. And when she calls Annie, she, that's the first time she calls her maid. She like says, oh, this is my, that was my maid. So she straight up calls Annie her maid. But then when I guess it's an agent. The agent's going to call the studio in Hollywood. She finally breaks down and says, no, 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 don't do that. And I don't know, I thought it was interesting. But again, sort of you see that arc of her progressing.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I thought was interesting when she comes home is that Annie picks up Susie in her arms and takes her off to take her to bed while Sarah Jane walks to her bedroom alone to put herself to bed. So I thought that was a good visual as well.
I don't know if you wrote it down, but when the director or the agent does sort of catch her in the lie, what does she do? White woman tears.
Oh, yes. Always. With
the crucible that can forge any metal.
Yeah, for
white
sure.
White woman tears.
For sure. okay, so I'm going to play actually a clip, I think, now, which is one of the first instances where you see, besides the woman with the black baby doll, and...
Oh, this is the classroom?
Yeah, so this is a classroom scene. And
has many names in many different countries. In Holland, he is called Sinterklaas. In France, Saint-Nicolas. In Sweden, he is known as Jule Tomte.
This is the first
in
grade
Germany,
class.
He is... Oh, can I do something for you?
Sorry to trouble you, miss, but I brought these for my little girl.
I'm afraid you made a mistake. I don't have any little colored girl in my class.
But they said 3B. This is 3B, isn't it? Why, there's Sarah Jane. There's my baby.
You mean Sarah Jane Johnson?
Yes, ma'am. I'm Mrs. Johnson.
The teacher's face.
Sarah Jane, baby, I brought you yours.
Sarah Jane storms out of the
Sarah
classroom.
Jane, we didn't know.
This is that score.
Jane, wait. Sarah Jane.
She grabs her coat. She runs into the snow.
Sarah Jane. Sarah Jane, wait.
Looks like it's PS number one.
Now, let me do it. Now, put your coat on. What do you want to do, catch pneumonia?
I hope I do. I hope I die.
Honey, nothing's hurt. You shouldn't have let them...
They didn't ask me. Why should I tell them?
Because that's what you are, and it's nothing to be ashamed of.
Why do you have to be my mother? Why?
So I'll just say, when that scene happened, we were taking notes, watching it, and we both... There was a double pen click, like...
Click, 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 click. Click, click.
Click, click.
Okay, so that's obviously pretty like self-explanatory. The thing that got me in that one, she says, they didn't ask me. Why do I have to tell them? So
right.
She's passing in first grade here, but it's a passive form of it. She's passing by omission. It's not a lie to her in this moment. She's let them assume what they wanted to, and she hasn't offered up information. So she says, they didn't ask me, why do I have to tell them? So I thought that was a big distinction because you know, later Sarah Jane's much more active in her deception.
Well, but yes, her role goes from more passive to more active in the passing, but the narrative of Annie, Sarah Jane's mother, kind of, I don't want to say outing her.
Oh,
but,
yes.
You know, that this is the start of that, and it's kind of what... You know, does them almost in the end.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so there's one more small piece at the end of the scene. Oh, no, they don't show that part.
Never. Oh, this is... She says, well, I'm white. I'm as white as Susie.
I'm as white as Susie.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Laura tries to comfort Annie and says, you know, what can we do? And she says, I don't know. And she says this quote, how do you explain to your child that she was born to be hurt?
And I wrote down that same thing because it just... So that Juanita, as an actress, just... She should have been, you know, Oscar nominated.
Yeah.
It was an unbelievable performance. But she says this because she was born to hurt. And there was a pause and they kind of held on her face. And I think unspoken is that she was also born to hurt Annie.
Yeah.
You know, she was born to hurt.
And
but,
born to be hurt.
Well, and it's like hurt who? Hurt
yeah.
herself, to be hurt.
To be hurt.
You know, by society, to hurt me, her mother.
Yeah.
It's just, again, not a word. It's like less was so much more
so
in that
much
sentence.
More. And they linger on her face, you know.
Yeah.
And such an expressive face she has. It's
well, and
amazing.
I don't know if you saw the commentary notes I watched, but the director said, or so a studio executive said to her, said, Juanita, if you're not good, this won't be good. Put all this pressure right on her. But the director sat with her every day, and would go over the dailies and would say, this little muscle here, this is because you're nervous. And so she really, she you know, thought very highly of him and thought that, that he did a great job in getting the sort of performance out of her.
Yeah.
But I think he said that they hired her because she had a kind face.
Right.
And she didn't know what that meant, but...
she does have a kind face.
Well,
you have to be able to empathize with her in these moments where, you know, she's in a difficult situation and,
yeah.
you know, you want her to be successful. The thing is that, and this is the crux of this movie, is you don't even know how to define success in this situation.
Mm.
And I don't think she does. So I think that's where the difficulty comes, you know, where she has that look on her face, like, cause she was born to be hurt and I don't know how to stop her from being hurt.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that would even look like for her not to be hurt.
Well, and what an amazing movie. And we keep saying there's these subtle bits, but you're saying, and I agree with you that the purpose is to empathize with Juanita's character, Annie. And for a movie in 1959 to have a, you know, a starring role for a black woman, albeit sort of a, you know, stereotypical mammy role, but one that's the heroine that is the one you empathize with in 1959, that's incredible. And I remember reading some things that I guess at the time people had, even more so the 34 version, had thought of this as racist in some way. And I don't know about you, but I think it's sort of the, I don't say the antithesis of racist, but it's a overt statement on racism more
yeah.
than overtly racist itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so let's keep going. So soon after this, Steve, who has just been hired to promote a brand of beer, he actually sold the photo he took of the girls,
right.
proposes to Laura, but she turns him down, saying that even though she loves him, marriage would prevent her from steadfastly pursuing a life in the theater. And just then, the agent Loomis offers her a role in a new comedy by well-known writer David Edwards. Steve forbids her from visiting Loomis because of what had happened last time, prompting her to accuse him of settling for less in his own career. He had wanted to be, you know, more of an Andy Warhol type photographer, you know, in the Museum of Modern Art and all of that. So they have this row on the staircase, and Lana really turns, notches up the drama in this scene as Laura. And Steve says to her, "What you're after isn't real."
Again, great line.
Great line. Great line.
Line.
That line to me is the actual point of the movie.
And you know what? And I don't want to spoil it, but the line that Susie, the adult,
yeah,
Susie
later on,
later,
for sure, it comes back to that.
Full circle. It's the full
it
circle.
It does. But to me, honest to goodness, that's what this movie is. What you're after isn't real.
And again, such a subtle. You know, the writing, it's Steve saying this to Laura,
yeah.
and it's clearly he's talking to her about, you know, what you're after isn't real, this sort of Hollywood dream of being this big actress. But at the same time, it's a beautiful parallel with Sarah Jane's desire to pass.
Absolutely.
From, you know, one class to another, Laura's upward mobility vis-a-vis acting.
And Annie. Annie wants her daughter
and
to be
Annie
a school teacher and
yeah.
marry some chauffeur or whatever. And Susie, I mean, all of them have this illusion of what they want.
Oh, I didn't even
want.
Think about Susie, what Susie wants later
it's
on
not
isn't
real,
real
either. It's all. This movie is that line is so critical in this
movie.
Really good. Okay, so during her audition with David, Laura suggests that he rewrite portions of the play.
Right.
Only a white woman would go into an audition talking about rewrite this shit for real. And though he's angry at first, he soon realizes she is right. And then he gives her a bigger role. So
yeah.
He
doesn't just do it. He says that no one has ever told
to
me
her like
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
yeah, of course.
I like, there's a bit of a female empowerment embodied.
There is,
by Laura.
And that's why I mentioned
again,
the dog scene earlier, because they definitely show Laura kind of coming into her own a lot more on the professional side of things. So she's cast in the play.
Well, and I don't, not to go back, but do you remember watching the movie? You're like a 1 degree of Kevin Bacon IMDb like vault, you know, faces and actors.
Oh,
just
I have a whole list
a
of people in this movie, so we'll come back
no,
to that.
No, but the scene where she's getting the job was
no,
the...
but that's what I'm saying. I have a whole list of where do we see them before in this movie.
Okay.
If we can talk about it now or we can wait till
well,
later.
Just it blew me away that you knew it. You
oh,
said,
oh as soon as I heard his voice, I
Dancing.
Can tell, actually. As soon as I heard his voice,
Dirty
I was
Dancing's like 20-something years after this.
Yeah, well, he's been in a lot of stuff.
I wouldn't have recognized him at all. And I said, oh, he was...
The actor's thinner. Name is Jack Weston, by the way.
Yeah.
He wasn't that much thinner, but
I said he was thinner, and you said he's still playing the fat guy.
Well, he was Tom in this movie, the stage manager.
I just can't believe you called that out. I was like, you gotta be kidding me.
I called one out earlier because I talked about the receptionist in Loomis's office.
Oh,
and I
right.
said it was Gladys Kravitz from Bewitched.
Well, I won't spoil anymore. I just you blew me away with that. I was like, are you kidding me? You know who all these people
are? I'm pretty good at that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't play that game with you.
No, don't. Not good for you. Okay, so where were we? Okay, so the play is a huge success. All the papers go on about a new star being born on Broadway, right. meaning Laura. And there's a scene between David and Laura after the reviews and everything is going so well. And she says to him, I feel complete.
Oh, you know, I'll go back a minute. So the play has ended, the opening night.
Oh, yeah.
And they're all cheering. And she's not the lead. So she's like the
right,
second
she's supporting lead. Actress.
So the two leads, the male and female, come out and they do their curtain call and about, and they start like cajoling her, like kind of, you know,
well, you hear a few
Heather.
People go, Amy.
Right,
Amy.
Right. So they're cajoling her to come out. And right when she turns, Lana does this so unbelievable. She's passing the curtain and she's seeing all the audience and a couple of people stand up for her. They do a cutaway shot, but they show her face and there's this tiny little lilt of her eye and a smile that's just, I don't know, it was just beautiful. Just this tiny little moment. And I feel like, and in fact, I think that's the moment that leads her to conclude,
I am complete. Absolutely. Yeah. She does complete there. And David says he loves her, but that he's worried that she only feels the way she feels about him because of the success and not because of him. And she honestly says to him, that might be true. I don't really care though.
Yeah.
She literally is like, yeah, I probably don't love you, but it's all good though. We can be together.
You know, when she said that to me, I had in my mind the character that Heather Graham played in Bowfinger, where she keeps sleeping
with
everybody.
Oh, yeah, with like more and more
people. I'm not saying that Laura's stealing everybody, but it's a little bit like, you'll never guess who I just had intercourse with in the van, right? Just like.
It's not that bad, but I think she's more just like, you know, I'm okay with how I'm feeling and it's feeling good right now. And
you know,
I don't need to add anything to that.
I shouldn't slut shame her. I called her female empowerment before. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Good for her.
Okay, so after this, literally they breeze through 10 years, start with her starring into hit after hit that David writes for her, and he wants to marry her. She admits to Annie that she doesn't love him. Annie's still working for her, mind you. She doesn't love him, but she thinks they might be good for each other. Now, I want to just mention here that at this point, because she's now successful, the wardrobe switches.
It's so funny. I wrote down that there's two things. This feels like the first, in my mind, like music video montage almost. Because they're advancing time by showing.
They show the year and then they show another play.
Correct,
and then her,
correct,
and
correct.
On stage and another
and there's
year
a score
and
playing.
Play.
But so they, throughout those scenes, her wardrobe
oh,
got
goodness.
Redonk. In particular, the necklace, right? The first, when she's coming back from, she goes to the. The agent's
office.
She's got on pearls.
Right.
She's got on pearls. She's her classic one string pearls. And then after this first review, and she says she feels complete, I think it's even the director puts the necklace around
on
her
neck.
And
yeah.
it's diamonds.
Yeah.
Right? And then at some point during these like advances, one, the diamonds got bigger. They added like rubies and sapphires.
Earrings, everything.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I think maybe you have it as a point, but wasn't it like $1 million worth of jewelry?
Yeah, it was $1 million worth of jewelry she wore during the movie. And her wardrobe cost $1.078 million, making it one of the most expensive in cinema history.
Just
at
her
time.
Wardrobe, not just the whole.
And let me tell you, she looked like $1 million, not joking.
I don't know if it was during this bit, but the white dress with the almost the
she
lace.
She has so many amazing Ooh. Dresses. The white dress, the pink pantsuit. The
Is
white,
that pantsuit the one she flipped onto the couch?
Yes.
Oh,
the
my Lord.
One white dress with just the blue sash on it. That silver dress with the
Oh
trim.
My God.
Get out of here.
She couldn't even walk in it.
Man,
she was doing
she
like
barely moving that thing, but she looked like
tiny little
amazing.
Footsteps. Yeah.
They don't
really
even
did.
Make outfits like that, much less put people in
Good
movies.
Good Lord.
In
they,
them.
They spent $1 million on a budget and they made $6 million on the movie that
yeah.
first year, but that would be the equivalent of like, I don't know, like a $300 million movie spending $50 million
yeah,
on somebody's wardrobe.
And this also comes back to Lana's real life coming into play because she had been known as a clothes horse and kind
oh,
of a
really?
Drama queen when it comes to her appearance and her outfit. You can imagine she's a matinee idol. And it was said that one of the reasons why she took the role was because the character in her success in the movie would allow her for all of these costume changes on a regular basis because she was an actress. So it's kind of interesting. And Lana's had this problem, as you mentioned earlier, throughout her career, especially later in her career where her personal life often spilled into the role she was able to procure.
Yeah, and so you talked about context. And I had no clue about that bit about her personal life, but I imagine the theater goer in 1959.
Oh, they were very aware.
Yeah, they brought all that, I don't call it baggage, but
backstory. Yeah, they brought the baggage, and I think that the director played it up for sure. So a few other things she mentions in this same scene with Annie, she says, and this is hearkening back to Steve's, what you're after isn't real. She says, you know, Annie, you make it and it doesn't seem worth it. Something is missing, she says to her.
There's another really wonderful point now is Sandra Dee.
Yeah, Sandra Dee is on the scene as the older Susie. Also, just a couple other things that I noted. Edwards comes in and he sees Sarah Jane, who's now played by Susan Comer. So she's also, I wouldn't say grown up because they're still supposed to be teenagers, but older teenagers, over 16. And he says to Annie, that daughter of yours is getting prettier and prettier every day. And she's so sophisticated.
I didn't catch that.
She says she's so sophisticated. I had this idea in my head of like, you know, when people say like, oh, you're so articulate or you speak so well.
Right.
There was this undercurrent of, oh, for a black girl, she's so pretty and so sophisticated. Also, Susie's already in boarding school, so her mom has shipped her off at this point sometime in this 10 years. And also a second black servant's added to the household. They have a butler now.
So I meant to tell you, did you catch his name at all?
They never said his name.
I had to look it up. Oh, I had to go to IMDb.
What is it? Tom?
So the character's Laura's butler. And then in parentheticals, uncredited Kenneth.
Kenneth.
And it was played by Napoleon Whiting. Give him a shout out. Napoleon Whiting.
Go ahead, Napoleon.
I don't think he had a line.
No.
I don't think
he did. He had a line when later when Annie is sick. He has one line.
It's funny. I wrote down, too, that she
goes
to
get the doctor.
And is this the same part where they had that almost throwaway scene about her spells and the doctor? Because I think she does. I think
maybe it's now. Yeah.
I think Laura asked Annie, just sort of again, they're doing better and things are wrong. She goes, oh, did you see your doctor about those spells?
Right.
And she said, no, you know, haven't this or that. And they don't waste a single sentence or line, but this is, you know, a full hour before she ultimately passes. And they're talking about her seeing a doctor and having
spells.
Well,
now you're really doing spoilers. Goodness.
I mean, if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't seen the movie, I apologize.
No, I won't. Too late now.
Too late now.
Okay, so Laura and David argue when she decides that instead of starring in his next comedy, she wants to be in a drama. She wants to push herself creatively. He gets all shitty and throws his dramatically throws the
he
play he
it
wrote.
Up.
And she's like, he made sick copies. Don't let him think it's...
Well, he said, not just he goes, my pride up in ashes.
Up in ashes. Drama.
But again, not a wasted line. Is he talking about the screenplay? Talking about her?
Yeah, he's talking about all of it. Yeah,
yeah, like, the dream.
Right.
Because he's gone. That was it. I think that's the last time
you see him. No, they show him once more at the funeral.
They show him come back to her play.
Right. So that's her performance, of course, is beautiful and brilliant. The play becomes an instant hit. And Steve appears back on the scene with some mamby-pamby girl on his arm. Laura confesses that she still loves him, and they reunite.
And, you know, I don't know if you noticed, but when Steve shows up with, again, she's like, so they spent $1 million on Lana's wardrobe.
They spent two bucks
on this poor woman. It didn't fit her at all. But so she's there.
She didn't even have a necklace on. I made a note. They did not show a single woman without a necklace on this entire movie until her.
Well, but so Lana just like... You know, it wasn't just kind of like, I fucking him. Like, she grabs him by the arm up close.
She grabs him and she basically
Let's
is like,
go,
girl,
dude.
Go ahead. And I'm not even trying to business with you.
Like a boss.
Like a boss.
Still a boss.
That's right. Susie, who has suffered from her busy mother's lack of attention, despite the material advantages Laura has provided her, looks forward to a trip with Steve and Laura. But their plans are canceled when Laura excitedly accepts a coveted role in an Italian film. Meanwhile, Sarah Jane tells Susie that she secretly has been seeing her white boyfriend and that she would rather die than be considered black.
Well, I'd go back a little bit because I noted two things that I thought were interesting. So there's all these subtle cues about Sarah Jane being left out of anything that's described as the family.
Correct. And I have a note of that, too, from her at the graduation, but go ahead.
So when it starts even earlier, but
it does start
Susie says, oh, a shooting star, and everyone runs out. no Sarah Jane. And, like, I don't know if that was like a 12-minute shooting star. It's a little bit ridiculous.
It was a long so then, ass shooting star.
As they're talking about that trip, they're talking about, you know, on a family, take a family trip. It doesn't include, you know, Annie or Sarah Jane at all. And then they actually...
She makes a comment. She says something like, I wish it could be just like this with all of us together. And everybody's there except for Sarah Jane.
Right. Exactly.
Even Annie's there.
Even Annie's there. So then, but before you get to the scene about her boyfriend, they have the picnic. And that's because they can't, you know, she's going to Italy to have this last little picnic. Steve wore an ascot. Right? Like, I don't know who... He's at a picnic with an ascot?
Hey, he's just making it happen.
I just thought that was hilarious.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can get this clip of Sarah Jane talking about her boyfriend.
Well, and isn't there... And I think there's another scene before that even. I thought about Susie asking Annie about kissing. Or is that after the boyfriend?
I
think it was before.
Cue that one up.
Well, that's okay, but I'll just mention really quickly. There's this narrative...
going to Annie for... going to Annie for more motherly advice, right? So Susie's going, instead of to her own mother, she's starting to go, you know, asking about boys, all these questions. So I think that's an interesting narrative and arc as you see that progress throughout the movie as well.
Yeah, for sure. And she even has like a list that she is trying to remember all the things right. She has to talk to her mother about because she never sees her. That's how little she sees her.
And it goes parties and kissing boys.
Yeah. All right. So here's the scene with Susie and Sarah Jane.
Jane, where have you been? I've been looking all over for you. You know, you're supposed to be in bed. Sit down. Cross your heart. You won't tell my mama?
No, I won't tell Annie.
Well, what is it? I've been out with my boyfriend.
Boyfriend? I didn't know you had a boyfriend. Where's he from?
The village.
Oh. Do you meet him in school?
School? No. There's an ice cream parlor in the village with a jukebox.
Yeah?
And he used to stand outside. And every time I'd walk by, he'd whistle.
No kidding.
At first I pretended he wasn't on Earth.
Yeah.
But finally I had to laugh. And he followed me. He started to talk. He's cute. Really cute.
Is he a colored boy?
Why did you ask that?
I don't know. It just slipped out.
It was the first thing you thought of.
I told you, it just slipped out.
Well, he's white. And if he ever finds out about me, I'll kill myself.
But why?
Because I'm white, too. And if I have to be colored, then I want to die.
Sarah Jane, what are you saying?
I want to have a chance in life. I don't want to have to come through back doors or feel lower than other people or apologize for my mother's color.
Don't say that.
She can't help her color. But I can. And I will.
But we've always talked things over, and well, you never told me this before.
Because I've never had a boyfriend before. Because he wants to marry me someday. A white boy. Me. But how do you think he'd feel or his folks with a black in-law? What do you think people would say where we'd live if they knew my mother? They'd spit at me. And my children.
Sarah Jane, you know that's not true.
It is. That's why he mustn't know her. I don't want anybody to know her.
What if he comes here?
He doesn't even know where I live. I pretend I'm... I'm a rich girl with strict parents.
He's bound to find out.
How? I'm going to be everything he thinks I am. I look it, and that's all that matters. And you're not to say anything either.
I won't, you know I won't. I never did, but Sarah Jane, if Mama ever found out, she'd never stand for it.
I don't care. Your mother doesn't own me.
I can stop it there. That's deep. There's a lot going on in that scene.
A lot going on in that one.
Very deep.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, she'd kill herself, right? She's basically saying to be black in 1959 is worse than living in her mind.
Yeah.
She just her desire to pass is so great that the alternative in her mind is literally death.
This is the second time she's mentioned that she'd rather be dead.
Yeah. You know, and there's a question that I was thinking I meant to start at the beginning with, do you feel that, that Sarah Jane's desire to pass is simply for the sake of whiteness or for sort of these opportunities that, that the privilege that comes with being white, like being able to work at a better place or have a, you know what I mean? Like,
I think it's at the heart where she says, why do we always have to be, go in the back? Why do we always have to be in the back? I think from her perspective, and I know that obviously every black person feels that they're just as good as a white person or any other person. Mm-hmm. But I think when you look exactly like this group of people that are trying to put you down, it's like that blue eye, brown eyed experiment that they did in that classroom.
Right.
You know, it's like, there's no reason. And there really is no reason anyways, obviously there is no reason. But I think that for a child, you talk about your psychological development, that you can only imagine the duality that you face, knowing that you look exactly like these people.
Yeah.
And their only reason for putting you and the people that you come from down is the way that you look. Well, but she, you look like them.
She mentioned both pieces. So she mentioned the desire to pass for, I would say, whiteness's sake, not being in the back of the room. But then she also, for the opportunities that, quote unquote, whiteness would provide her, marrying a white husband, and she's saying that she's rich and wants to, you know, lead a different life. It's interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't think it matters her motivation, right?
No, it is what it is. One other thing that just a note visually in the scene, all of the matinee idols and singers and stuff on Sarah Jane's wall are all white.
Yeah, you pulled that out instantly. Like, oh, look at all the pictures on her wall. They're all white guys. Mm-hmm. I hadn't noticed that at all.
Yeah. And then they go to a scene where Laura asked Sarah Jane to help her mom out. She's having some people over.
Well, and this bit with the boyfriend, and I even meant to say, I took a little bit of umbrage. She says, that's the first thing you thought of. That's the first thing you said. It's like, no, she asked, is he cute? And where'd you meet him? And she had a few other, And she, I don't want to say it, was it appropriate, inappropriate? I think for the time it was appropriate.
Right.
But I certainly don't think it was the first thing she said.
No, she's obviously hypersensitive to that.
Correct. So, she's leaving that encounter sensitive, and now she's entering
the
main house, I guess, like downstairs or whatever.
Downstairs, yeah.
And Laura's having a big party with all her, you know, people over, and because she's a star now. And Annie's helping. I forget what his name was. What was the other butler's name?
Kenneth or some shit.
You already said Kenneth. Well, I forgot. I got to scroll up and find his name now.
Jeffrey.
Napoleon. It was Kenneth. Kenneth, good call. So she's got to help Kenneth with sort of the stuff in the kitchen.
Okay, so I have that clip as well. Hold on a sec. We can play that one.
Need rehearsal. She won't.
Fetched you all a mess of crawdads, Miss Laura, for you and your friends.
That's quite a trick, Sarah Jane. Where did you learn it?
Oh, no trick to tote, Miss Laura. I learned it from my mammy, and she learned it from old massa, for she belonged to you.
Well,
excuse me.
The dress in this scene is to die for.
I've got a drink, Signora.
Want the blue sash.
Sarah Jane, why did you do that? What's the matter with you? Annie, did you see what she did?
I heard her.
You and my mother are so anxious for me to be colored. I was going to show you I could be. You weren't being colored. You were being childish. I don't understand why you would want to hurt your mother or me.
I told her she has to be patient. Things will work out.
How? Miss Laura, you don't know what it means to be different.
Have I ever treated you as if you were different? Has Susie? Has anyone here?
No. You've been wonderful, but
then don't ever do this to us again. Or to yourself. You won't solve anything, Sarah Jane.
This bitch right here.
Yeah, almost telling her to keep in your place. But, you know, and we didn't mention that the end of the scene with the time of the boyfriend, your mother doesn't own me. And then she comes down and says, like, you owned my mother's mother.
Yeah. She belonged to you.
She's laying it on deep.
Yeah, she's laying it on deep. But Laura's character are just like, have I ever treated you badly? As if this is one of those like things where you say something about racism to somebody and they're like, well, one time my white cousin got beat up by some black kids.
There's no racism. President Obama's black.
What does that have to do with anything? And a hill of beans, nothing.
Yeah. You know, as you're talking about race and this, I think this scene had a lot so there was more subtle bits. This was maybe one of the more heavy-handed. I mean, she comes in, you know, y'all want some crawdad? Like, it was pretty heavy-handed. But so Juanita, I saw an interview with her in one of the liner notes where she was talking about catching a bit of flack, and that Delilah, who played Delilah Johnson, played the role in the 1934 movie,
right,
caught even more flack. And so there was this whole, like, you're playing mammy characters, you're not really helping. And her quote was, I'd rather play a maid than be one.
Right.
And when Juanita was talking about it, she said in her own, so it's 25 years later, she said, I had five sisters that have college degrees that were all domestics. So she knew a bit about, you know, that life that and what it meant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I always thought it may be unfair. I think that's just people attack to attack. But, that, you know, they're working, they're on their craft, their trade, and they're getting, you know, what is she supposed to do? Turn that role down?
Right.
It was Oscar nominated. You know what I mean? It might have defined her career.
Sure.
But she definitely got flack for it at the period that she did it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely, mean, talk about Hattie McDaniel, the first black woman to win an Oscar, and she got it for literally playing Mammy. That's her name in The Home with the Wind.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a level of, the white community would have accepted that role. So, of course, she's rewarded for it.
Of course.
So I think that's where some of that pushback
historically
would have come
from. There's an absolute context for it.
Yeah, for sure.
In fact, this was 59 and Gone with the Wind was just a few years earlier.
Yeah, just a couple of years. One thing that I did want to mention was that right before the scene where Sarah Jane comes in with the crawdads, she has an exchange with Laura. And Laura says, oh, are you meeting? Is it a date? And she's like, yeah. She goes, oh, is it that Hawkins boy from down the road, like the chauffeur's son or something like that?
And in fact, she had a good line. I think I wrote it down because she says that she's asking about all these different men, this person, that person. And it's clearly that they're, you know, they're black folk.
Right.
And I can't remember what her line was, but she said something about, you know, I don't want to date bus boys and
chauffeurs.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So Sarah Jane does end up going and meeting up with her secret boyfriend.
And I would say, as you listen to this, the score, again, is just tremendous. It's so, typifies this kind of movie and just the way they use the music and the score to build tension and release. But I thought it was Gershwin-esque and sounded almost like Porgy and Bess. I really thought it was just a tremendous score.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so we'll go here.
Frankie, you're late. I thought you'd never get here. Let's walk down by the river. I want to talk to you.
We can talk here.
Frankie, I'm having trouble at home.
Your mother?
Yes. Frankie, you said you wanted to take a job in Jersey. Couldn't we run away? I'd do anything to be with you. Anything.
That's not a bad idea. That's not a bad idea at all. Just tell me one thing.
Yes?
Is it true?
Is what true?
Is your mother a nigger? Tell me. Tell me!
What difference does it make? You love me.
All the kids talking behind my back. Is it true?
No!
Are you black?
No, I'm as white as you!
You're lying!
I just lingered because that score is insanely good.
Yeah, like I said, that what do they call it, the muffled trumpet.
Yeah.
It just, it sounded like Porgy Bess. And then right when he drops the end bomb, the score, sounded like West Side Story. Yeah, it got real intense.
It got really intense, yeah. So a few things about this particular scene is that her being black not only entitles him to break up with her,
right,
but he gives him carte blanche to literally beat her in the street.
Yeah.
Her blackness.
And you mentioned, so this scene ends and we paused it and we're taking a break. And you said that right away, that her blackness invalidated her, like her femininity immediately.
Everything, not just her humanity was invalidated. Yeah. Not just her femininity, her humanity. She literally goes from person that he loves to animal in that moment of him confirming that she's black.
Yeah. And if you hadn't seen the movie, he doesn't just beat her up. He slaps her repeatedly.
Yeah. You know, forehand, backhand.
He beats her up. Yeah.
Yeah.
He bloodies her.
Bloodies her.
And, you know, did you know when we paused it and we came back what scene it was on? Like the cutaway.
Right to Annie rubbing Laura's feet.
Immediately.
Which is funny. They only have one scene of that in the 1959 version. In the 1934 version, it's a repeated visual that they use, and it actually caused a little bit of a stir. People said, you know, some people didn't like that black people were touching a white woman, even though it was a black woman. There might have been some lesbian undertones to it, even though there weren't.
Do you mean saying that there was an undercurrent of black people in film shouldn't even be touching white people?
Correct. And that black people in life shouldn't be touching.
I mean, she's rubbing her feet.
Correct.
Feet. And I didn't know that about the 34 version, but in the 59 version, I actually thought that scene, it was on some level, it's like, oh, she's rubbing her feet. But there was a friendship there.
There was.
It showed a bond between the two of them that really...
In fact, let's play that clip because I think, yeah, I have that one. Let's play that one because I kind of thought there was some other stuff in it that was really relevant too. And you're right, it does really show their connection to one another.
So interesting that was thought of as lesbianism in 34.
Here we go.
Oh, it felt so good. And I'm glad the guests have gone.
And I'm glad you're not going to Italy.
So am I. Fellucci wanted me in Rome in 1 week. But I won't miss Susie's graduation. Not for anything. You know, I can't believe it. Susie and Sarah Jane all grown up. You and I have gone through a lot together, haven't we?
Years of flying. I'm getting old.
You never sounded so solemn before. Don't you feel well, Annie?
Oh, just a little tired.
Do you need anything? Any money?
No, Miss Laura. Thanks to you, I'm well fixed.
I've pledged to send Sarah Jean to college, and something set aside for her, and enough for my funeral.
Well, Annie, that funeral again.
Well, I'm getting on, and that's the one thing I've always wanted to splurge on. I really want it elegant. Got it all written down the way I want it to be, and all the friends I'd like to have there.
It never occurred to me that you had many friends. You never have any visitors.
I know lots of people. Oh, hundreds.
Really?
I belong to the Baptist Church, and I belong to several lodges, too.
I didn't know.
Miss Laura, you never asked.
Mama, Annie, quick, it's Sarah Jane.
I'm going to pause it there, because I think that's...
Yeah, we can stop at that.
I think that is, like, if not the best line of the movie, one of the best lines
for
of the
sure.
movie. Because she literally says, it hadn't even occurred to me.
Mm-hmm.
They've been living together for a decade.
Yep.
I just said that her rubbing her feet showed this sort of connection and this bond. And then in an instant, she makes it very clear that she doesn't even see her as a person.
Yeah, it's a connection to a point. It's a connection to a point. It's a connection because I think she loves Annie and I think she loves Sarah Jane, but there's still a black person.
Yeah.
I think that's true today. You know, we talk about that all the time, you know, in terms of modern race relations and this inability of certain white people to empathize with black people. And this is a direct
we just played
example
the,
of that.
The tractor trailer yesterday was Dear White People.
Yeah.
And it starts off with Dear White People. The number of black friends is acceptable to no longer be racist is 2.
It's been increased to 2. Right.
Yeah. But it's interesting that, like I said, there's this scene that connotes and conveys this friendship. And then she kind of strips away some of her humanity. But what I really loved was Juanita. And I don't know if it was Juanita or the director. But she says the way she delivers that line, like, Miss Laura, you never even asked.
That's right.
It kind of, it gives a, and she's not a mammy role. That's not really true. But, you know, people gave her that flack for this. But it almost, it gives some respectability is the wrong word. I don't know. Yeah. But, you know, she kind of, you know, as most as she could in 1959 with this sort of, you know, this narrative that we're talking about that, oh, you're just, you know, black people should be in their place, continue to be our servants and smile and be happy. It's always like, bitch, you never even fucking asked.
Right.
You know, and she didn't say it, of course, like that. It's 1959. But it was
more like, yeah. Okay, what do you think? I was just sitting around here with my thumb up my ass.
Yeah. And Juanita really kind of killed it. Like, Miss Laura.
You never even asked
me. You never even asked.
All right, so let's continue in the story. Susie graduates from her boarding school in a white dress, I might add. A little Emma Willard not there. And while Laura is filming in Italy, because, of course, the director comes around and will take her a week later, Steve looks after Susie, and the eager teenager soon falls in love with him. Sarah Jane, meanwhile, claims to have accepted a job in a New York library, but Annie finds her singing and dancing in a seedy New York nightclub. Her mother's appearance, of course, gets Sarah Jane fired, as they did not realize she was black, and she runs again from Annie, causing Annie to faint.
If you're going to play that scene before it, I thought you, as you're kind of going with the synopsis, there was that bit where Laura comes for the graduation, surprises Susie. She's like, oh, you're here. And she's like, I got you that thoroughbred horse you wanted.
Yeah.
So she's all excited about this horse. And it's interesting. So we talked about the sort of the two different arcs and the heart of the story is about relationships between mother and daughter and, you know, Laura and Annie. Yeah. But here, Laura can give Susie all the money and all the things,
yeah,
but none of her time.
None of her time.
Whereas Annie can give Sarah Jane all of her time that's not wanted.
Correct. I also made a note that the song that Sarah Jane sings at this club is called Empty Arms.
Oh, I had noticed that.
Yeah. I had a lot of irony there.
Are you playing that scene?
No, I'm not going to play that. So Annie also makes a comment after the argument with Sarah Jane, after she gets fired from the club. She says, nobody's all right about everything and nobody's all wrong. I thought that was a really good line as well.
Yeah. And she says, let's talk about
it. Yeah, let's talk about
it. All she wants to do is talk.
Yeah.
And that's all she wants. Mm-hmm. And oddly, that's all Susie wants from Laura and isn't getting.
Correct. Yeah. Back home, Annie tells Laura, who just returned from Europe, that she will no longer interfere in Sarah Jane's life and that she does hope to at least help her or see her one more time. Steve, who is now vice president at the ad agency, learns that Sarah Jane is working as a chorus girl in Los Angeles, and Annie, convinced that she's dying, flies to California to first summon an airplane for one last look at her daughter. Sarah Jane is furious, exclaiming, I'm somebody else. I'm white.
Yeah.
So we're going to play that scene.
And before we do, you'd pointed out as we were watching this, and I hadn't noticed, but the makeup team was very subtly making Annie look sicker and sicker.
You know, her eyes are getting dark. She's very dry skin. Yeah.
And back to that line about nobody's all right, nobody's all wrong.
Yeah.
Very, again, intentional, subtle. It's not just about Annie speaking to Sarah Jane. It's about every character in that movie.
Sure. And it's about herself, too. Yeah. She has to realize that this pushing of her daughter to just accept being black and acting like there's nothing to talk about with regard to her race, it's not working. You know, it's not working. So let's go to the scene.
This is after she's run away and confronted
in California.
Somebody's coming. That's why the door is unlocked.
I'll only stay a minute. I just want to look at you. That's why I came. Are you happy here, honey? Are you finding what you really want?
I'm somebody else. I'm white. White. White! Does that answer you?
I guess so.
Then please, Mama, will you go? And never do this again. And if by accident we should ever pass on the street, please don't recognize me.
I won't, Sarah Jane. I promise. I settle all that in my mind. There's just one thing I wish from you.
What?
If you're ever in trouble, if you ever need anything at all, if you ever want to come home and you shouldn't be able to get in touch with me, will you let Miss Laura know?
Yes. Yes, anything. Now, will you go?
That wasn't all I wanted, honey. life. It was only part of it.
What's the rest?
I'd like to hold you in my arms once more, like you were still my baby.
All right, Mama. All right. Oh,
Sarah Jane. Oh, my baby. My beautiful, beautiful baby. I love you so much. Nothing you ever do can stop that.
Oh, Mama. Oh, my baby. Mama.
Oh, my baby.
Okay.
Play the rest of that in a minute, but there's a lot going on.
I have the rest of it.
Oh, you don't? No. Okay.
So they have an exchange there where Annie basically says that she was Sarah Jane's nanny. She should take care of her. And the chorus girl that's a friend of hers says,
"So, honey child, you had a mammy?"
And Sarah Jane says, "Yes, all my life."
I love it. Mm-hmm. And again, there's this sort of meaning within a meaning, you know, just so much with each word is just deliberate. But when she says, you know, I want one last thing, and, you know, she's like, "Oh, what?" And she goes, "I want to hold you in my arms one more time like you were my baby." And I don't know if they meant "were" like you were my baby as in a small child, or "were" like you're not my baby anymore. Mm-hmm. You've disavowed me. You know, you've disowned me to some degree.
Yeah, she says it's already settled in her mind. She's not going to ever see anything to her again. She's not going to ever see her again. If she does pass her on the street, she's going to act like she's a stranger. So she does lose her child.
Well, and that was something that I, you know, again, I don't have a lot of context, but being with you and sort of learning about this stuff and specifically passing, I guess one of the, if you really think about it, the hardship is that you're, in order to achieve, quote unquote, social upward mobility by passing as white, you've got to give up all your family.
Absolutely.
You've got to cut ties.
Yeah, you have to cut ties completely. And then there's also a fear that comes in. You know, there's a lot of stories about women who were passing or men who were passing trying to get rid of children that they had conceived because there's a fear of, you know, what's the child going to look like and all of this stuff. So, yeah, I don't know if you've ever read the book or seen the movie The Human Stain. That's about that, yeah.
Okay.
It's very
And you don't have the scene. I guess it really wouldn't make much sense because she whispers it. But so after the chorus girl says, you know, or the mammy lines after Annie leaves, after her mom leaves. But as she's leaving and she's, you know, saying, "Okay, goodbye," the daughter, Sarah Jane, says, you know, "Goodbye," and then mouse the word "mama."
Mama, yeah, it's to Annie.
It's just heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. It really is. So meanwhile, Laura and Susie argue over Steve. As I mentioned before, Susie is now in love with Steve. And when Susie accuses Laura of loving her career more than her mother, Laura offers to give up Steve. And Susie, this is when she declares, "Mother, please stop acting."
Well, even before that line, she says, and he says, you know, Susie says, Annie has, because the first thing is Laura finds out that Susie has this sort of real crush on Steve.
Yeah.
And that upsets her. Mm-hmm. And then she finds out that it's coming from Annie, that Susie felt comfortable telling Annie, but didn't feel comfortable telling Laura. And, you know, Annie's like, "Be nice, this, you know, this." But she comes down and Susie throws in her face, "Annie has always been more like a real mother to me. You've been too busy." Mm. And then that's when she says, "I'll give up this." And she goes, "Stop acting." And again, that's one of those, is it Susie talking to her mom, Laura? Is it every character?
Yeah.
Stop acting.
Stop acting.
Except every character except Annie. Annie's been real pretty much from the jump street.
So I am going to interject the story about Lana Turner here because I do think it's relevant in terms of...
And I know very little of it, so good.
Okay, great. Kind of mirroring Lana Turner's real life troubles with her own daughter. She had one daughter. So Lana Turner met Johnny Stampinato during the spring of 1957, shortly after ending her fourth out of seven marriage. At first, Turner fell for Stampinato's good looks and prowess as a lover, but after she discovered his ties to the Los Angeles underworld, and particularly he was a bodyguard for Mickey Cohen, she tried to break off the affair out of fear of bad publicity. Stompanato was not easily deterred, however, and over the course of the following year, they carried on a relationship filled with violent arguments, physical abuse, and repeated reconciliations. In the fall of 57, so you can see how close this was to the filming of the show,
two years.
Stompanato visited, this happens later, I'm just giving you kind of, this is all leading up to when she goes to film this movie. In the fall of 57, Stompanato visited Turner in England when she was on the filming Another Time, Another Place, which co-starred Sean Connery. In her autobiography, Turner says she arranged for him to visit because she was lonely and having a difficult time during filming. The reunion was initially happy, but the two soon began fighting, and Stompanato became suspicious when Turner would not allow him to visit her on the set, and during one fight, he choked her so badly she missed 3 weeks of filming. Turner later wrote that she and her makeup man, Del Armstrong, called Scotland Yard to have him deported. Stompanato got wind of the plan and showed up on the set with a gun threatening her and her co-star Sean Connery, whom he warned to keep away from Turner. Connery answered by, of course, because he's so badass, grabbing the gun out of his hand and twisting his wrist, causing him to sheepishly run off the set.
Wait, wasn't Stompanato, had mob ties?
Yeah, I just said he was the bodyguard for Mickey Cohen.
Damn, James Bond.
But you know, Connery don't care about that crap. He's a man's man.
Apparently.
He's out there in the streets.
Respect.
Turner and Armstrong later returned with two Scotland Yard detectives to the rented house where she and Stompanato were staying. The detectives advised him to leave and escorted him out of the house into the airport where he boarded a plane to the U.S. Okay, so fast forward to April 4th, 1958. So this is really, really right before she starts filming this movie. In the Oscar telecast, which she had attended without him, Turner and Stompanato began arguing heatedly in her house in Beverly Hills. Fearing for her mother's life, Turner's 14-year-old daughter Cheryl grabbed a kitchen knife and ran to Turner's defense. Many theories as to what happened. There's a lot of theories out there about it, but it appears the teenager stabbed Stompanato, killing him. The murder quickly became a media sensation. It was later deemed a justifiable homicide at the coroner's inquest, at which Turner provided dramatic testimony.
So I not only did I not know before, but I didn't know anything. So her daughter stabbed the guy?
Yeah. The way that the scene kind of played out, the way they said, was she kind of went in there to kind of just scare him away, but he was not easily scared away. And, it wasn't that she lunged at him per se, but he kept advancing on her and almost walked into the knife. Not that she, she stabbed him, but it wasn't kind of stabbing, if you know what I mean.
Well,
I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, we weren't there, so I don't know exactly.
No, I'm just telling you what the court found.
Sure.
Was that it wasn't I'm coming to stab you. It was more like, hey, get away from my mom. And he was like, fuck you, I'm not going to get away from your mom.
So the theater goers didn't just bring a little bit.
Oh, they brought
a lot.
A lot.
A ton.
And she starred in Peyton Place after this, which she won an Oscar for, which also has a huge theme of issues between mothers and daughters.
And did Lana, after this incident, have an estranged or a good relationship with her daughter?
I don't really know too much about that. I know her daughter, she wrote a autobiography after this and talked a lot about her mother, obviously. I don't think it was bad. I know she had supported her, but I do think that she was kind of, there was a little bit of this Laura in her where she was kind of focused on herself. And like I said, she had her daughter with her second husband, and she married seven men ultimately. So just to give you a good idea, seven. That's
and
a
I don't
lot.
Know what you're gonna say.
And almost all of them. In fact, one of the man she had divorced right before she took up with Stompanato, her daughter accused of molesting her. So that ended the marriage.
And all that's in the news. That's all information.
Oh yeah, that's bring. Well that is directly from Cheryl's autobiography. So
wow. Yeah. And I don't know if you're gonna play the scene or talk about it, but so immediately after the stop acting, Annie and Laura sort of come together and they're talking in Annie's bed. And she said something about that. I know you meant to be the best mother. I did too.
Yeah.
And it's sort of this, I don't know, a bit of a weight between them. Sort of like, wow.
Yeah.
You know?
I said that the women have a discussion about the kind of mothers they have been.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me in watching that scene that Annie could only give herself to her daughter, but it wasn't enough for Sarah Jane.
Right.
And that Laura could get everything but herself to her daughter, and it wasn't enough for Susie. So there they are, you know.
And each of the other parents had what the child wanted.
Yeah.
Annie had the time for Susie, and Laura had the influence, whiteness, and money for Sarah Jane.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Very.
So one day Annie tells Laura to make certain all of her possessions are left to Sarah Jane. This is when your butler friend has his big...
His line?
His big line. Annie needs some help. I called the doctor. Kenneth, whatever his name is. And after reassuring her old friend that she's going to glory, she dies.
Well, and I wrote down, I don't know if you did. She didn't just say it. She goes, I want to be high step into glory.
High step into glory.
High step into glory. And at that moment, Laura goes like,
oh, yeah, she breaks down, yeah.
You can't leave me. You can't.
You can't.
Like, white tears can save even you from, I guess, cancer death.
Yeah, she says, but, you can't leave me. I won't let you.
I won't let
now,
you.
Now, I thought what was interesting about that line is that she's not saying, like, you know, you can't die. You can't
I don't
leave
want
this
you
earth.
To die.
Just,
I won't
you can't
let
leave
you.
Me. You can't leave yeah. me. I'm the one who needs you. It
well,
doesn't
even
matter.
The, even the I won't let you is rife with ownership.
Yeah,
you know?
It totally is.
And backtrack a little bit before she actually passes away. She's going over her sort of possessions, and she had a couple of lines I thought were kind of interesting where she says, give the pearls to Susie,
oh, it's Susie, Susie right.
for her wedding day. Mm-hmm. And she makes a comment about the two great events of, in your life, your
right.
wedding day and your funeral.
Right.
Again, referencing this big funeral chef. But she said to the reverend, and I'm only laughing because of the personal tie-in, but she says to the reverend, you know, give my mink scarf to your wife. She never believed me that it was real. Oh, no, she believed you. She believed
she
you.
She believed
you. And I know you know this story, but we have a family friend. We'll just call her Aunt Jerry. And she's not going to listen to this. I love her to death. No one knows her last name. So Aunt Jerry. But she, like, raised us. She, you know, lived a few doors down. And, you know, really, we call her aunt for a reason. But a very successful business her and her husband had. And at one point, they I guess, sold it for a bit of money. And she had bought a mink. And she's telling my mother, like, oh, she's buying this mink. And my mom had said to me, like, oh, you know, it's kind of strange because for, I think, like a decade, she had been talking about her mink.
Right.
And been saying, my mink, for like a decade. So my mom, I guess, like, I don't know, she confronted her or said something. And in a, you know, maybe it was a couple of glasses of wine. She goes, oh, that's raccoon. So here's, I just think it's funny.
I thought it was rabbit.
Rabbit. Well, it wasn't mink.
It wasn't mink.
So here's, Annie has a real mink, but the
right.
reverend's wife doesn't believe it
right.
is. And our Aunt Jerry had a fake mink, and we all
right.
believed that it was.
All right. So at the funeral, the great Mahalia Jackson sings at the funeral itself, which is really moving and totally beautiful. And I actually read that Mahalia was actually offered the role of Annie at one point,
oh, really?
But she turned it down because she's like, y'all know I'm a singer, right? I don't really,
you have to have her song.
I don't really do that.
Cue
yeah.
Up.
I'm going to cue that up. So, she's high stepping to glory. Here we go.
No.
That's the end of the white woman tears. Bom, bom.
You can't leave me.
I will be done. Trouble of a world, Lord. Trouble of the world, trouble, Lord, of the world, how sooner will be done. Trouble, Lord, of the world, I'm going hard to live with God. No more weeping and wailing, no more weeping and wailing, no more weeping and my trouble of this world, oh, my trouble in this world, love and trouble in this world, Lord, how sooner will be done. To trouble of this world, I'm going home.
So that's Mahalia.
Killing it.
Killing it. So a few things about the funeral itself that Annie planned. I also want to mention that there was also a black maid that was added to the household. I did reference that. They had a black man, black butler, black minister, but a white doctor, FYI. Yeah.
Laura keeps making more and more and getting more and more servants.
Sure does. So they had about 36 ushers / pallbearers with like red sashes on. In the audience, they show the milkman, who was a small character when they were living in the small flat in New York City. They show Loomis, the old agent, probably still her agent. They show the old boyfriend, Edwards. Everything is white. The casket, the flowers, the coffin,
the horses.
All everything, white everything, all white everything. One thing I mentioned, though, this was such a like small detail, but it just struck me that it was such a like black thing, was that she bequeathed to the milkman not just $50, but a crisp $50 bill. And I thought to myself, a white person wouldn't think about that aspect of it. I don't know why, but I just do not. It was very authentic to me. Like she wanted it to be a brand new $50 bill for the milkman. Anyways, she had a full marching band. She had a glass goddamn carriage.
The other thing you're glossing over is Miss Laura said, "Well, it didn't occur to me that she had any friends." She had a shitload of friends at this funeral.
People was on the street crying, hats in hand,
packed.
As the coffin's being driven through the streets of New York, there's people kids in trees, people on balconies. I mean, you'd have thought she was Mahalia herself, the way this was going on.
Certainly enough friends that you'd think that Laura would have noticed one.
Right. So the movie ends in the funeral. As a long cortege moves slowly through the street, Sarah Jane pushes through the crowd, flings herself on her mother's coffin, and weeps hysterically. And I mean hysterically. Yeah. She says, "I didn't mean it. I killed my mother." She's like, really?
Well, she goes, "Mom, I didn't mean it. I did love you.
I did."
And then says she killed her mother.
I killed my mother. So Laura and Susie gently lead her to the hearse, where they reassure her that she did not cause her mother's death. And as Steve looks on, the three women join in hands, a gesture of comfort and love. And that is the end of The Imitation of Life from 1959.
And it just ends, scene, right, like that.
Yeah, that's it. That's the end.
And I think we on our last podcast, pointed out that she just died, but that was my mistake. She actually would have been 100 on yesterday,
the day we watched the movie.
Yeah, so she died January 1st of this year, 2014.
At age 99.
But would have been 100 on Sunday. So
absolutely.
Great, great movie to review for our first Interracial John vintage.
I had a few more kind of follow-up things.
Okay.
One was to just go through this, a little feature I'll probably have when we do all of these, which is where have we seen them before? So there, as I mentioned earlier, there's a receptionist in the Agent Loomis's office, played by Sandra Gould. And you would recognize her as the nosy neighbor from Bewitched, Gladys Kravitz, neighborhood Snoop. And then, as a very white guy also mentioned, the stage manager, Tom, in the first production of that Laura gets put onto is played by Jack Weston, who is also Mr. Kellerman in Dirty Dancing, who owns the club or whatever the hell it is. I think it's even called Kellerman, so.
I think it is.
Yeah, for sure. Frankie, the boyfriend that beats up Sarah Jane, is played by screen idol Troy Donahue, FYI.
Yeah, yeah.
And we mentioned that Sandra Dee plays the teenage / adult Susie, who is the original Gidget.
Look at me.
Uh-huh. And finally, Loomis, the agent, is actually played by Robert Alda, who is the father of Alan Alda. So
I did not know
he's been
that.
In a lot of things. I won't go through his whole purview. Okay. And so then I mentioned, I just want to read this little clip here, that today Imitation of Life has been reevaluated by critics and is now held up as a masterpiece of Douglas Sirk's directing style. Emmanuel Levy has written, quote, "One of the four masterpieces directed in the 1950s, the visually lush, meticulously designed and powerfully acted Imitation of Life was the crown jewel in Sirk's crown, ending his Hollywood career before he returned to his native Germany. Sirk provided the Annie-Sarah Jane relationship in his version with much more screen time and more intensity than the original versions of the story, and critics later commented that Juanita Moore and Susan Conner stole the film from Turner. Sirk later said that he had deliberately and subversively undercut Turner to draw focus towards the problems of the two black characters."
And so, again, I think that's so astute for someone who wasn't maybe because he wasn't American.
I think because he wasn't.
And, you know, so we're talking about the sort of humanity that, Juanita possesses and gives to this character, Annie, that's almost surprising. And it's – I don't know if I read this or – but so when Annie dies, there's less of a – you're not like – it's not a gut punch more than it's sort of like a release of the pain and tension of a troubled life, maybe. I don't know.
I mean, I think it's a sad statement that she says in the film that it's the one thing she's always wanted to splurge on. It's like, you're not even going to be there. Yeah. Why are you splurging on that? Because there was this idea of, like, you know, the hereafter, that's where my glory is going to be. You know, these trials and tribulations that I face here, I'm going to be beyond them at that point.
And
so
even to the sort of her death being less a tragedy, more of a release of tension and pain, her last words are, I'm just tired.
She's tired.
So tired. And again, it's like, does she mean physically, emotionally?
Of life. Of what?
Yeah.
She's just fucking tired, man.
It's the
bullshit.
Just doesn't have a wasted line. The screenplay was great. The book material obviously was tremendous.
Yeah.
What a really wonderful movie to do for our first vintage review.
Great. I mean, we're probably not going to get to do these super often, but I think it'll be fun to do. And if anybody has any suggested vintage movies, so we classify vintage as pre-1976, FYI, is our classification for vintage.
A classification of vintage.
I have
movies.
Added that classification to a rule for the vintage
pre 65.
Yes. No, pre-76.
Oh, pre-76.
Not 65.
Okay.
Pre-76 is considered vintage.
Yeah, because I made a slight list, one of my favorites with you, Seven Brides for Seven
Brothers. That's definitely pre-76.
And Place in the Sun.
Oh, gosh, I love that movie.
Love that movie.
Great
love
movie.
It. And I said Mahogany before.
Yeah.
And what's the one?
Might be post-76, though. We'll have to look at that.
I keep wanting to call it Tex. Is it Texan Oil?
No, what was Giant.
Giant.
Yeah, Giant's a good
Giant.
One.
I've only seen that the one time.
That's
so
a great one. Butterfield 8's one of my big ones. You know I'm a huge Liz Taylor fan, she's going to be
featured. Father Knows Best.
Oh, gosh, that movie's so funny.
See, that would almost be, because this was a little, I don't want to say it was heavy. But,
this was heavy, yeah.
But it fit in with the interracial John.
Sure.
It was very appropriate on many levels.
I like these older movies that tackle these heavier subjects, though, because I think movies nowadays, like, you have to pick what you want to be. Butterfield 8's a great movie where it's like there's some really, like, pretty intense themes in that movie. You know, she's a call girl, there's this party line aspect of things, but there's still humor there. You know, she's funny, and so I like that aspect of it. There's a lot of duality there. I think actresses then, to be successful, you had to be able to do that, and I don't know if that's necessarily you're not going to see Anna Faris doing something like that.
That was a updated modernization, but Barbara Streisand played a prostitute. I can't remember it. Somebody died and she was on trial, and the trial ended up being about her.
Oh, that's someone with Richard Dreyfuss?
Yeah,
I don't know about Nuts. I think it's
I think it was called Nuts as well.
And that's definitely post-76, so post-76. We won't be reviewing that at all.
Okay. No worries.
Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of that movie, but
I wasn't Streisand. Saying it was a good movie. That's what I was saying. I was making a comment about Streisand and sort of tackling these sort of bigger
issues.
I
think that movie was about mental illness, though. So
it is, but even that, I don't think you see a lot of movies tackling those sort of things. Certainly not in this big blockbuster $2 million.
Yeah, definitely not.
Wardrobe budget.
Yeah, for sure.
Lana Turner way.
All right. Well, that's it. It's in the bag. First episode. Nice. IRJ, Vintage Movies.
Well done.
We'll see you guys next time. We did it. All right. Bye.